Okay. Yeah, I can pass out those. So here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna give you seven. Those are there. I want to give you these seven kind of categories. It's really three characteristics and four competencies. So we talk about skill and character. But if you're wondering or you're asking, and those questions are already emerging, like even as we were doing the little interview thing, the question is, okay, well, what kind of leadership, what does the shape or face of leadership look like in this new power systems? In dispersed, empowered, called, networked forms of church. What skills are essential for leaders or for leadership in that context? And I actually think that is such an important question because we cannot just take an old power training curriculum and think that that's going to serve us in a new power system, a new power form. It is not. And there's all kinds of there's we were I've already had several conversations on the side just about the way that we understood leadership. I mean, the way we were taught what is leadership, just fundamentally, what is it? You know, I think there was probably, if I go back in my own mind, I think there was probably, I started with a sense that leadership was mystical. That it's like some people have it and some people don't. And you either have it or you don't. But then, you know, so it's the mystique of the kind of, you know, what Jim Collins would call like a level four leader. They're just, whoa, they're just, they have that certain something. But then I think the more I was a leader, tried to do leadership, I started thinking, and the more I read on leadership, the more I began to believe that leadership was mechanical. That actually it's just about technique. If you could learn the right technique, make the right move, say the right thing in the right place, right time, well, that's what makes you a good leader. And I would say, by and large, that is what the body of literature on leadership proposes, that it is about technique. But I've come to believe, and I say recently, I want to say in the last 15 years, I've come to believe in someone like an Edwin Friedman's point of view about leadership, which is that leadership is essentially emotional. Leadership is an emotional transaction. It's basically an emotional transaction. So this is very rough for the men who are like shut down on their emotions or don't understand their emotions. You're in trouble. You're in trouble in the future because the way to lead forward. And by the way, if you're a woman who is a little more friendly to your emotions, you ought to feel great. This is your world. Anyway, I don't want to go off on that tangent too much, but you know, leadership, I think, in the time in which we live, is about emotional intelligence, and it has something to do with vulnerability, honesty, and emotional courage. So I'll talk more about that in a little bit. In fact, that'll be the last thing. I'll circle back to that at the end. So let's just start with this. And then what I thought would be fun to just keep you engaged. It's probably isn't gonna be fun, but less boring is if you actually rate yourself. So if we look at this, as I go through these one at a time, and feel free to, again, stop me and ask for clarification, but as we go through these one at a time, I thought it'd be good to kind of plot yourself on each of these. Now listen, no one's going to see this except maybe the person next to you or who you want to. Don't lie. Be honest with yourself. Be brutally honest with yourself because you'll be able to see your own kind of profile. And what I hope actually you see is where you can actually plot in our little time together. You can plot where you're really going to need to grow to fit into this new power system. Because if you just overestimate yourself or do a self-serving bias, you're the only person that loses in that transaction. So just try to be as honest as you can to say, I don't remember how exactly I phrase it here. So like a 10 would be, oh, what a relief. This is me. You know, I rock this. You know, I totally embody this value, this point of view. So give yourself a 10 if that's how you feel. As I'm talking, you're like, thank you. That's what I do. That's who I am. That's what I've always been saying. If that's how you feel about it, give yourself like a 10 or a 9 or somewhere in there. All the way down to a 1 of like, oh, crap. You know, I don't really think I do this at all. I don't do this well at all. So give yourself like a 1 there. Is that clear, that spectrum? You guys okay?
High enough.
Yeah, right. You can. it's like self defeating. This is sober judgment. This is about sober judgment. I would say too, if you just think classically, this is kind of how I lead, and people would say about me, this is how I lead, then I think you can give yourself maybe a higher score in that regard. Cool? Sound good? All right, cool.
Would you say more on design?
Yeah, what is that?
Well, I'll get there. I'll say more on all of them.
Oh, good.
Yeah, don't score yourself yet. We're not. We'll go one at a time. We'll go one at a time.
It's easier if we don't know what they are.
So much easier, yeah. You guys already... I already did great. I don't know. Oh my gosh.
We're Germans.
The Germans already did it. All right.
All right. So, new systems, creative economy, new power networks, all that stuff. What kind of leadership is required? Let's start with servanthood. Paul says this in, was it 2 Corinthians? For what we preach is not ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord. Jesus as Lord. And ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. There could not be a more potent line in all of Scripture for this idea. Listen again. For what we preach is not ourselves. So, the megalomania, the big ego dynamic, this is the Apostle Paul's heart to that. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. The central thing is Jesus as Lord. The Lordship of Jesus, the reign of Jesus, the kingdom of God. Kingdom of God. That's what we preach. The Lordship of Jesus, not ourselves. Can you see the importance of that contrast? Can you already see that even in the first century, before the church was even in diapers, they were already struggling with personality over and against the kingdom? With the problem of, I follow Apollos, I follow Paul, I follow Cephas. There was already an issue in the church, right? Particularly there in this Corinthian context. But what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus as Lord, and ourselves. So we do have to talk about ourselves. We are leaders. We are important. We are part of the equation. So we don't preach ourselves. We preach Christ as Lord. But we do talk about ourselves. We are important. But if we're going to talk about who I am or the role I play in this community, the voice that gets raised above the rest, then here's what we'll say about ourselves. As your servants for Christ's sake. So if we're going to talk about ourselves, which we do, we have to, then here's who we are. We're your servant for his sake. So I know you've heard the idea of servant leadership. I know you've done Bible studies on, you know, Jesus washing his disciples' feet. I know that maybe you've read Robert Greenleaf's book, Servant Leadership. Maybe you've read, Ken Blanchard's stuff on servant leadership. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about servanthood as a technique to gain the upper hand over your people. I'm not talking about servanthood as a way to get people to follow you. or do what you want, or follow your vision, or align to your ideas. I'm not saying servanthood is something that you use like a tool to gain leverage in the lives of your people. I'm saying it as if you are their servant. That's what I mean. That when you look at this other person who sits in your church or who comes along or who is a part, one of your emerging leaders or something, you think, I exist to serve this person. That's what, they are elevated above me. Not I am elevated above them. So some of the language that betrays this for us is like, those are my leaders, or those are my groups, or they're, we have this sort of over-under language. And I think if we're going to retain that kind of language, then let's reverse it. And the highest leader should see themselves as the bottom of the hierarchy, not the top. So again, I'm not trying to be clever or trendy. I really think this is like a profound, ancient, important principle of biblical Christian leadership. And in the time in which we live, it's incredibly significant and incredibly potent as a leadership quality. So if in the end I don't really care what happens to me, I don't care about my own name, I don't care about the success of something I'm doing, I just want to see you emerge and become the person you're supposed to be, then how I measure my own sense of worth of the thing I'm doing is by how well you do. Imagine that. If we thought what makes a leader great is not like some of these big churches that are around this area, they had great leaders at the very top, and we drooled over how amazing leaders they were. But if we measured them based on how well their people do, of all the kind of amazing things that came out from under them, it would be a different calculation. And that's what I mean, at least for the time in which we live. Has anyone read Donald Miller's Story Brand thing? Anyone seen that? One person? Come on, guys, read more. Yeah. I'm just kidding. I found it boring. But one of the things he says... Did I hurt someone's feelings? Or is someone related to Donald Miller or something? Anyway. Is someone related?
What German?
Bueller.
I don't know what that means. Okay. I'm not going to waste time. One of the things he says in terms of the story brand is like that the problem with the way that people are presenting their idea or their brand or their thing they're trying to sell is that they're the hero of their own story. And he says that what you have to do in the time in which we live, what works, is to actually not position yourself as the hero of the story, but to position your client or the customer. They're the hero of their own story. And it needs to be about them. This is what he's arguing. It's not meant for ministry or Christian, but it certainly applies in those contexts too. So what he's saying is what the role that we play is like the guide. That's his language, the guide. You see yourself as a guide. So it's like Luke Skywalker and Yoda. Luke Skywalker is the hero of the story. Luke Skywalker comes in, he has some major problem which he's trying to solve, and then Yoda comes along to be there to help him learn and figure out what he needs to do and who he can become to solve that problem, to defeat the Empire, whatever. You follow me? Star Wars? No? Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So I love that language because I think it represents, because it's so native to the time in which we live. It's like you are not the hero of the story. Your people are. You know, if you use my rubric, the microchurch leader is the hero of the story. You're Yoda. You're meant to be a guide. You're meant to be to help them, serve them, to become this thing that God has called them to become. And you know you did your job if you serve that thing and they become the person God wants them to be and to see birthed the idea or the ministry or whatever that God wanted to see birth in that. So that's what I mean by servanthood. So could you just go ahead and give yourself a score. Raise yourself a nine. If at any point somebody feels like, man, I'm really thirsty, I'm going to go get a drink from the McDonald's thing, could you get me one too? No, you don't go now unless you're going to anyway.
Oh, you should.
All right.
Servant.
Look at him. You all blew it. You had your chance.
Yeah, he gave himself a 10. That's right.
Thank you.
Change my score.
We all gave him a 10.
Yeah. He gets a 10 now. He gets a 10. All right, give yourself a score. Okay, number two. Is the second
modesty
thing...
Modesty is zero.
Is the second thing modesty?
No.
Yes. Is that the second thing? Okay. Let me give you another word. Let's say prophetic humility. Prophetic humility. Here's what I mean by that. Organizational humility, structural humility. Organizational humility has to do with like learning. It means you're always looking at what you do and saying, maybe this isn't work. Maybe this isn't right. Maybe it needs to change. We could always do this better. When you start really overly committing to a strategy or a pattern, you really undermine your ability to lead, because your people will say, in fact, over lunch, we just had a discussion where it's like, somebody was saying, well, we try to change the church, try to do something in the church, and people are mad at us because they say, you just were changing it last year or the year before last. As if somehow to say, we changed our mind, or we thought this was the way to go, but turns out maybe it isn't, shows a weakness in leadership. It's a flaw to have changed your mind. I remember watching two presidential debates ago. I remember watching a candidate. I think it was a primary debate. So it was one of the parties. And somebody said, oh, this is my position. I forget what it was, on immigration or something like that. And another candidate said to them, that's not what you used to believe. Mm-hmm. And they sort of roasted them for saying, you know, you're on record as having said this other thing. And they were just all mud on their face and could recover. And I just sat there thinking to myself, how sad this is that we see it as a weakness to have changed your mind. That something you thought 30 years ago, you're supposed to hold on to, hell or high water, to show what? Certainty? Intellectual strength? What does that mean? And I'm thinking the last person in the universe I want to vote for is a person that cannot change their mind. That cannot learn. That cannot learn. For me, it was an opportunity to say, yeah, I used to think that. But it's the funny thing about me, you know, I grow, I learn, I read, you know. I'm smarter now than I was 30 years ago. Check that out, you know. You're not voting for the 30-year-old. Old version of me. You voted for this one, the smarter one, the wiser one, the one that can learn, whatever. So that's part of what organizational humility looks like. It's always willing to ask the question and always actually asking the question, what can we do differently? What can we do better? Probably what we're doing is inadequate. What's the problem? What's the problem with that? We're Christian. We believe in the doctrine of sin. Right?
Yes.
German Baptist. We believe in the doctrine of sin. Everybody is sinful. So why do we ever need to sacralize some idea or program or pattern or whatever and say, this cannot possibly be wrong? That's the opposite of what we should believe. We should always hold on with real like institutional humility to say, no, there's loads of things to learn. Thank you, my friend. Anyway, and then in a personal sense, that means like as a leader, that looks like transparency, it looks like openness, it looks like vulnerability, it looks like actually preferring to not be in the spotlight. This is important. It's not that we won't be in the spotlight or refuse the spotlight, but it's that we actually would prefer not to be. And that's an internal question only you can answer, actually. But you know the answer, you know the truth. You know the truth. And I'll say, you know, someone asked me this question earlier. I will say that has been a tug of war for me personally. And there's times where I think I enjoy the spotlight too much. And so I, as an act of spiritual discipline, you guys are very spiritual. As an act of spiritual discipline, I will restrict my public ministry. I'll fast from public ministry because my soul matters more. And actually, the texture of my leadership as a whole is affected by that. To say that it isn't or to believe it isn't is not, it's naive. You know, one of my heroes is Nelson Mandela. And it's not just that on principle, you know, he spent 27 years in a prison in Robben Island. You know, to some degree, that was outside of his own control. But what you may not know about Mandela's story is that there was so much pressure against apartheid at the end of his term in prison. There was so much pressure against the South African government. I mean, if you remember, if you lived through that, it was just like everybody was just roasting South Africa for being so backward. And, you know, Bono was after him. And it was bad press. So they actually wanted Mandela out of jail. And they went to him and said, listen, we want to let you out. But you just need to promise you're not going to, like, blow anything up or anything like that ever again. And Mandela said, not that he was going to blow things up, but that he would not be controlled by their terms. And he stayed for an additional 5 years. Do you understand? So you're 22 years in prison, wrongfully, as an act of oppression. They say, we want to let you out. All you got to do is just promise you're not going to do something which you already aren't going to do. And he refused. It remained another 5 years. Even more powerful to me than that is then when he gets out, he becomes president. He's instantly famous, instantly loved, and he becomes, you know, the first black president of that nation. After 5 years in office, he's a lock. He could stay in office for as long as he wants, and he refuses a second term. I want you to think about that. Because he wanted other people to lead. I honestly think he only took the presidency because of what it meant to his people. I don't even think he was eager to be president, to wield that power, or to be in the spotlight. But even that he did as a servant. And that expresses itself because when it came time for a second term, he was not interested. He could not be convinced. This is what I mean by this kind of prophetic humility, this trait of modesty. It's just who we are. So clearly, I don't come off as a very humble, modest person. So it's not a personality trait. That's not what I mean. It's something more true to your character, who you are. Because I know I can come off, I personally, you know, struggle to express that soul condition. Sometimes I undermine myself, and it's still a struggle for me. But it's a commitment. Sometimes this looks like elevating the marginalized, finding the voices that need to be heard instead of yours. You're always wanting to promote other ideas, other voices, other people. That's a part of what modesty looks like. Okay? So give yourself a score on that. Okay. What's the next thing? Design is the next thing?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a guy called, I think, Roger Martin, who came out of the University of Toronto, maybe. And he wrote a book called Design of Business. This would have been 10 years ago, maybe. And it was, no, probably more than that. And it was massively influential in the business sector. And part of the reason why is because the time in which we live, which I make this argument in my book, but it's because we live in a creative economy, it's no longer about consuming or consumption. It's now about our ability to create. And people want to create. And so suddenly design, or the process of design, becomes an essential tool in leadership. Aesthetics is important all of a sudden. So now you have Fortune, you know, 400 companies, Fortune 100 companies who are hiring MFAs into their C-suite, which just makes no sense. Masters of Fine Arts, you know, painters and poets and to come into their C-suite because design thinking suddenly can be applied to the work of enterprise. And I think that this suddenly is a not just marketable, but possibly essential skill. Can you design infrastructure? Can you design new forms of whatever you're doing that have to emerge quickly and be contextualized? This is something that is incredibly valuable to quick, rapid fluid systems. Because essentially what you have to do is you have to learn in the tight feedback loop, you have to learn what's happening, try something, iterate, learn, iterate, learn, iterate, learn. And then from that learning, you design something. So we're talking about systems that are constantly under evaluation and constantly being redesigned. So it's a skill, the ability to see how things fit together, not just set up for efficiency, but also set up for beauty. That's part of what a designer does. It's not mechanical necessarily or with efficiency or production as the end result, but it has something to do with aesthetics. It has something to do with beauty. So design can be industrial design, engineering kind of aspect, which is the underneath part of the system, but then it's also aesthetics. It's the front, it's the face of the system. Do people look at this thing that you've created, this new system that you've designed, and think, well, that's really attractive. That's really interesting or beautiful. That's a part of the skill that we need. Taking these raw materials, producing and designing something that people say, this really represents us. We're proud of this. I love Seth Godin says this, we think our job is to copy edit the world, not design it. And the world in which we live now, your job is not to copy edit, it's to design. So we have to think like artists, we have to lead like artists, and it's a new skill which we didn't learn in seminary, which we have to somehow master, which has to do with design. Do you understand the contrast in the metaphor there? A copy editor is making little changes to make a thing better, right? We're not just talking about small changes to perfect or improve the thing anymore. We have to increasingly design programs, groups, and systems from scratch that meet the need of the moment. Maybe the best example I can use of this is, you know, Elon Musk decides he wants to do a space program. Anybody remember this? This guy's a trip. So he's like, I need rockets. So he goes to the Russians because he's like, they've got rockets they're not using, right? So they have like CX rockets. They're old. They're like 70s tech. They're 40 years old, but they're not using them. So he's like, I'm going to go get them. So he goes to the Russians. The Russians, they're not going to give him a good deal. They're the Russians. So they say 50 million a rocket. And Elon Musk, like, that's too much. And apparently you can't really bargain with the Russians. So, and he's like, wait a minute. You want 50 million for one CX rocket, and it's 70s tech. It's like dial-up modems over here on this thing. So what does Musk decide? This is a very 21st century leader, right? What does he decide? How hard could it be to just build your own rocket? That's his mentality, right? By the way, it's very hard. turns out it's way hard, you know? And all his rockets crashed, you know, for the first, and he almost ran out of money. Ended up being just as expensive to just, like, learn how to make rockets. But he thought, well, surely I could get the right smart people, engineers, and we could just make our own rockets, and we could do it cheaper, and they'll be ours, and they'll be cutting-edge tech. And he did it. He's done it. And that's an example from that's native to our time of what it means to be more of a designer than like a consumer. We don't just go out and buy the old 70s tech. We have to make our own. And it's actually cheaper, and probably in the end, it'll be better. So rate yourself on that. Design as a...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So it's also getting together a team, though. So it's not like you have to do the doing, but to surround yourself by those who can.
Absolutely. So, and it may be, well, but it may be that you say, well, I'm not strong in this area. So you surround yourself with people that are strong in that area. But it's still good to know I'm not strong in this area. Because actually, if you rate yourself low, it's not over for you. It just means exactly what she said. You'll have to build team to strengthen where you're weak. But we're trying to assess where you are personally in each of these things. Okay, what's the next one?
What did I say?
Coaching. All right, good. You with me? You okay energy-wise?
I'm with you.
Persevering. Thank you, my friend. All right. So if the heart is servanthood, the skill is coaching. If the heart is servanthood, the skill is coaching. So my heart is, I am your servant for Christ's sake. But the skill you need to actually execute that, I think, is coaching. This is a combination of like mission focus and experience with counseling, care, and listening skills. So it's like the counselor bias, you know, I want to listen. I want to ask you good questions. I want to feed back to you what it is you're saying with a bias and a focus on mission and development. So that's what coaching is. Coaching is not counseling, and it's not leadership. It's not actually telling someone to go somewhere or to do something, or it's not teaching. It's not delivering some idea so that they go do that idea. It's a combination of listening, caring, feeding back, and having this goal in mind in that conversation or in that relationship. We're trying to actually accomplish something. You're trying to accomplish something, and I'm here to kind of help you do that. It really is about personal development and about the mission itself. So coaching is impossible. Listen, coaching is impossible without a mission. If there is no mission, you're not coaching. You're counseling. You're supporting. You're doing something else. Good things. But you're not coaching. So what I mean, this skill is required. This skill is only active when a mission is present. I'm going to coach you toward this mission. So those of you that have shepherding gifts, that are like a shepherd type person, this might be something really close to you, really, really, really reachable, attainable for you. But it requires an injection of mission and missionary intent in the relationship. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish? What kind of team are you trying to build? Let's talk about that. Let's get you there, which you need to go. But let me use my shepherding kind of mentality and gift here to get you there. So it's empathy with a focus on Jesus and his mission. This is related to calling and servicing calling. So a person needs to know what their calling is, have some clarity on that, and then you can come alongside to service that calling and that person in that calling. So I've said this before, maybe I've said it to you, I don't know, but if the two deepest longings of human beings are intimacy and purpose, which I think is true, one of our deepest needs is to be loved as human beings, to believe that we are loved and known. And the other possibly sort of dual deep need is to be significant, to feel like matter in the world. And I think calling is the unique coalescence, the conflation of both of those things at the same time. It's that profound that God knows me. If he called me, that means he knows me. It means he wants me. It means I matter to him. And then secondarily, it means he has something for me to do, which means my life matters. It means I have an assignment. It means that I'm significant. And so I just cannot think of a more profound thing to introduce people to in their walk with God and their discipleship than personal calling. For both of those reasons. So if that's true, that those two things are kind of primary longings, they should only ultimately come from God. We cannot nor should we ever supply that to people. They have to turn to God to get it. They have to. They should not look for their primary intimacy from us, and they should not look for their sense of significance or purpose in the world from us. There is one God and one mediator between God and man, Christ Jesus. Not you. So beware, be careful. And so what coaching does is it pulls us into a place of triangulating between God and the person, and not into a primary role of mediation. That's a dangerous place because there's only one mediator between God and man, which is Jesus. So how do we serve that relationship as a coach? It's a better model, I think, for leadership in our time because it allows for this triangulation. It allows us to say, actually, your relationship with Jesus. What has he asked you to do? Let me help that. Let me serve that. Back to Donald Miller's thing. Let me be your guide in the pursuit of that relationship and both calling to Jesus, which is like spiritual formation and depth and intimacy and all that prayer, and calling to mission from Jesus, which is significant for the growth of the church and the building of the kingdom of the world. So I want to serve that relationship. That's what coaching does. So we can have true empathy for the person, and if we do, we'll want them to come to the deepest possible knowledge of both those realities. That's what coaching does. If all I do is just think about, if I just do like spiritual direction, where I just want to sit down and talk about your relationship with the Father, your personal relationship with the Father that has to do just with intimacy, I think we've actually come up short in really loving and leading that person. Because without them engaging in the thing that he has called them to do outside of themselves, they will never fully develop. And their relationship with God will actually also not fully develop. They need to be obedient to what he's asked them to do to find their best life or their best self or whatever. Does anybody follow soccer? Anybody like soccer? Sean. So, Sean, I'll talk to you. So, Sean and I are both Manchester United fans, big Manchester United fans.
What? Now we're soccer fans.
We're just Baptists. We just like to disagree.
United are actually owned by Tampa ownership, so the same people that own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers own Manchester United, so that's my connection. But I've loved them for years. Sean and I love them. We follow them all the time. And they've struggled the last several years to win trophies. And they're a very successful, historically successful club. And they've struggled with managers. They've had managers come in. And the last manager they had was this sort of egomaniac. And it was his way or the highway. And he just couldn't, what you call in soccer, man management. He couldn't do man management. Like, he couldn't handle these other players that were bigger than life. And he didn't want to share the spotlight with them, and he had a lot of problems. So they fire him. They fired this guy in the middle of the season, and they bring in just an interim guy, just a guy to get them through so they can get a marquee coach in the next year. This is one of the probably two or three most valuable sport franchises in the world. So they've got money to spend. They need to get a top-tier coach, right? So as an interim, they bring on this old ex-player, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Norwegian striker who scored like 150 goals or something like for United. He is beloved, right? Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. They love him. They bring him in just as an interim. They bring him from some little podunk club in Norway. Just hold us over as an interim until we can get a proper manager in here. Well, something extraordinary happens. He just starts winning, like every game. I think he went like 17 games without a loss or something like that. They just took off. These players, which were massively underperforming, they couldn't gel as a team. No, the strikers weren't scoring goals. Midfielders were losing the ball. The defenders were dreadful. All of a sudden, he just bringing out the best of these people. So everybody wants to know, what is Ole doing? How is he doing this? And eventually, they're kind of like, we need to hire this guy. We need to actually bring him on as the proper coach. So they sign him to a big deal. So as soon as they hire him on as their full-time manager, contracted manager, they have a press conference with him. Sean, did you see the press conference when he took the job, the official job? If you care, you won't, but if you're interested, go watch it. It is, in my mind, a clinic in 21st century leadership. This is essentially what Solskjaer says. He's so unanxious, unselfconscious, very positive, but this is the promise he makes to the press, to the fans, and to the players. This is what he says. He says, look, I am who I am, and I'm not going to apologize for that. I'm going to be positive, and I'm going to believe in these boys. All he ever says about them is good things. He just always builds them up. The last manager was always critical of them publicly and so on. He just builds these boys up. He said, these boys are amazing. And he said, all I can promise to you is that I will be, listen, this is the key word, I will be the best version of myself I possibly can be. and whatever happens is what happens. And then he said, and what I promise I will do is that I will try to make these boys the best version of themselves they can be. Not fit them into my system. This is crucial. Not fit them into my system because my system works. Not follow my leadership. But I will develop these boys, these young men, to be the best version of themselves. So whatever their skills are, whatever they bring to the table, I want to see that emerge. Do you understand? That's why he activated these young players, these 22, 23, 25-year-olds. Because what he told them is, don't do my system. Don't be what I want you to be. But who are you? And how do I make you the best version of yourself to bring out your best skills, your best thing? That's what coaching looks like in this time. That's essentially what I'm seeing as a skill. And by the way, you might think, well, that doesn't sound that difficult. It's very difficult. It is nuanced. It's something that will take practice for you. So go ahead and rate yourself on that. Coaching. What's the next one?
Collaboration.
Good.
I've heard enough.
This might also look like something like coalition building. So being able to not just work with other leaders, but the ability to find each other, convene around meaningful projects, and work from positions of strength, creating that win-win-win dynamic. So every now and then you might see a couple churches get together for like city worship night or prayer or something, or, you know, that kind of thing. That's not what I mean. I don't mean collaboration for the sake of a fleeting, superficial sense of unity. I don't mean collaboration for a feeling of unity. That is not what I mean. There is some push for that. Maybe there's value in it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not eager to collaborate with people in the city so we can feel like we're collaborating. What I mean is co-laboring toward something, to actually drop off egos and say, you, your organization, your church, your community, bring something to the table. Mine brings something to the table. Their brings something to the table. Let's actually have some corporate thing which we dream of, which we're trying to do, and we all work toward it. And no one needs anything from it except the outcome that we're all dreaming of and working for. That is a 21st century leadership skill. And we're completely inept at it. We're not trained to work with other church leaders. We're not trained to work with other Christians. We're only trained to work with people who are under us, who report to us. Our expectation is if we cannot deliver quality control, because collaboration has to do with compromise. There's no way that you'll be able to get exactly what you want out of the thing. I see this in Europe. Just being in Europe for a short time, I can see that the way things get done in the church in Europe is completely collaborative. To just show up and say, hey, it's all going to be under my name or my banner or whatever, and if you don't want to do that, then you can't play, or we can't play. Nothing would get done. Nothing would get done. Everything is a collaboration. And I think that that is actually a sign of the times, and a sign of what's coming for us too. That increasingly we will not be able to accomplish things in our cities that we want to accomplish if we cannot work in partnership with other people and other ministries. Which means putting on the table your own outcomes, your own egos, all that stuff, and saying, we just want this thing so bad that we're going to work together to get it. The ability to find people, to build relationships, to be trusted, and to trust, that's all a part of this kind of collaboration. So I've been doing a lot of kind of reflecting recently on kind of founding collaborative partnerships, because I think we've all been lied to. We've been tricked. And we've been tricked to believe in what has been called the great man myth. That history is shaped by essentially these primary actors, singular people that sort of bend history to their will. And then we go back and tell the story as this singular individual person, the Teddy Roosevelt, the Winston Churchill, the Martin Luther, And we actually think that that's how history is shaped. It's shaped by these great people, these great individuals. And it just is not true. That's not how history plays out. But it's how we like to tell the stories of history because it has a nice narrative arc to it. But I started really looking at these kind of iconic companies in recent times. And I started realizing, man, the whole thing is just an illusion. For example, there is no Steve Jobs without Steve Wozniak. Wozniak's like a 200 IQ. He did everything. Do you understand? He engineered everything. There is no Apple without Wozniak. But we tell the story, and Steve Jobs is a real douche anyway, so that's not, I don't even know why we elevate him. He was a bad person.
He's dead now.
Reed, I'm sorry. God rest his soul. Rest in peace. I just finished his daughter's biography, Small Fry. He wasn't a good father. You know, it's like, anyway. But there is no Steve Jobs without Steve Wozniak. There is no Bill Gates without Paul Allen. You know, what is the juggernaut company in our time? Wrong. Fair enough. Jeff Bezos, fair enough. I would say Google, which is this incredible partnership with Sergey Brin and Larry Page. They're equals in every way. Where's that story? Where's that biography? No one knows what to do with it. So it doesn't get written. Where's the individual singular leader who had the vision and everyone followed and they didn't care and they fought against adversity and they did it? No, they're just friends. And they committed to something early on, and they've stayed true to it, and they've been equals through the whole time. It's an amazing partnership. I'm really fascinated by Jim Henson and Frank Oz, Ernie and Bert. And I read the story recently of how one day they just grabbed these yellow puppets, and they stuck them up, they started talking to each other. One with the pointy head, and one with the round head. And that's their personalities. Jim Henson was the playful, goofy, non sequitur, and Frank Oz was a more nervous, rigid, sequential guy. Ernie and Bert, nobody? Yeah, okay, good.
That's it. That's
it. Got it? All right. Bert and Ernie, sorry, I said it wrong. I said it backwards. Wow. Precise. The Germans are precise. They're equals. That's right. It doesn't matter. But that represents an amazing creative partnership. I mean, what became like a puppetry empire? You know, Frank Oz would have been behind all the Star Wars puppets, and of course, Jim Henson is all the Muppets. But they were super close friends, and that creative partnership really built that kind of puppetry empire in that time. It's just fascinating to me how we don't know what to do with that. And I look back at my own story, and I feel sad. I feel like a little bit of regret, like I wish I would have walked more with a co-founder or something, you know? Like I just thought it wasn't the thing to do. Like you're just supposed to be the singular leader and you just gotta suck it up, and leadership is lonely, and you know, somebody's gotta bear the weight of that. And so you do it for your organization, you carry that weight. And the truth is, even though I've tried to evade some of the negativity of that, the truth is it's tiring. It hurts you a little bit to be alone. There was some years ago, maybe almost 10 years now, 9 years ago, where I came under some real accusation because I had a relationship with a woman who was not my wife. It was a friendship, didn't escalate to anything, but it wasn't quite right. And I knew that, everybody knew that, my community knew that, but we couldn't shake it. And I didn't know what to do. Now, do I like reject this person? So, and some years later, that relationship came under scrutiny. And all of a sudden, I was, you know, questioned, can we trust Brian? Can we follow him? I had been elevated in certain people's hearts and minds, and I came crashing down through that. Some of it was unfair, wasn't true. We had to go through a whole kind of adjudication kind of thing where we had to figure out what was true and what was false, because certain things were being said that weren't true, but some things were. I mean, some things, it's like I'm a flawed person, I made mistakes, you know, I wasn't unfaithful or anything like that, but it wasn't right. It wasn't right. And I had to repent of it. And I had already repented of it and all that stuff and had gone through kind of community, but it came back out again, came like into the light, and everyone knew. And I was very open about it, and it was very painful, as you can imagine. And I look back at that time and I wonder, you know, I think it hurt us. You know, it hurt our development, it hurt our growth. In some ways it was fine, it was good. Like a lowering of me is good. But I think back and I wonder if I'd have had a partner, like a co-founder, if it would have been healthier for our organization, where all of a sudden this one person who you put actually too much trust in, too much belief in, comes under question. And I needed to go, there needed to be a period of time. It was like a year almost, where that was just like up in the air. You know, has Brian done something bad here? And they needed to ask that question, and we needed to go through that process. And at the end, maybe you get vindicated or something like that, but man, all that time lost. And I just wonder if I'd have had a partner, like a co-founder, if the organization would have been healthier, because that person could have remained kind of trusted while I was questioned. And that would have been good, right, and healthy, important to do. And maybe I could have done the same for them if they would have called into question. This has to do with the how robust the organization is. So we've bought into this belief that the leader needs to be the lone person. And I just think that's a dead end. Like, you're going to let people down. It's not if you're going to fail morally, it's when. It's when. It's not if, it's when. I can see you don't like this, but I'm pushing. If you have not already failed morally, don't, and by the way, don't get all judgy with me either right now. If you're feeling that way, watch it. Don't get judgy with me. You know, what it reveals is that I'm a human man. There was never going to be, the whole thing with Bill Hybels. What I wish he would have done when the stuff started coming out about the mistakes he's made and errors he's done and stuff, why didn't he just admit it? Why didn't he just say, yeah, I'm a human man. I made loads of mistakes. You don't even know. I made more knees, you know, because I'm a worm and I'm a turd. And I try to be a good leader, and I've failed all. Are you really going to go 35, 40 years of ministry and never make a mistake morally? Is that a thing? Do you guys think that's possible? It's not possible. You could cover it up, possibly. You could escape public knowledge, but it's never going to happen. You are going to let your people down, which is precisely why it cannot be built entirely on you. It cannot. And the beauty of this, like, option that I'm laying out for you, this trajectory I'm laying out for you, is it shouldn't be anyway. It's an inferior path. So I'm letting you off the hook. You don't have to be the singular leader. You shouldn't. It's a bankrupt approach. And that ought to relieve you a little bit, because there will be a time where you let your people down. There will. Where you have a breakdown, or you get a little sideways, or you do something immoral, it's going to happen. And when it does, there needs to be the possibility that your thing that you've started, your community, which you're a part of, is fine through it. It's fine through it. And actually, they could be there for you. They could support you. They could walk me through that whole thing and see me through it. And in the end, sort of forgive me for what needed to be forgiven, chastise me for what needed to be chastised, and vindicate me for where I need to be vindicated. And all three of those things needed to happen. You okay?
Yes. Are there any thoughts that maybe it could even have been avoided if you had someone right there with you the whole time?
Maybe. That's a great point. I did have a lot of people close to me, so I operate in community. But, you know, it's... Yeah, they tried, and I tried to listen, but, you know, flawed people.
So you have to want that peace.
Yep, and you got to prepare yourself for the inevitability of your failure, and that's why collaborative systems are better, because they're more creative, they're healthier, they're stronger, they're more robust, and also they prepare for the inevitability of your singular failure. Oh man, this is such an uncomfortable point. Write it down. What do you think? Give yourself
nobody,
collaboration.
Nobody talks like that.
Okay. All right. So
No, I feel like you need a support group out. Because my husband left and he's in trouble. He's so glad that he left because when you talk about moral failures, I just get mad at him. Like right now, it doesn't matter whose it was. I'm mad at him.
Okay. Good.
Brian, can I ask a question?
Sure, please.
I wanted to, whether it be you, I almost feel when you talked about being adventurous, risk takers, and all that stuff, embedded in that is the option for failure. In
yes.
other words, if I am not, failure is an option.
Yes.
And I don't mean morally or anything. But
no, I understand.
When you do stuff, we are built for success that if it doesn't work, we don't feel like running.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, in fact, failure is celebrated. Failure is feedback. So in an iterative startup world, which I'm saying that's the world we want to step into now, the idea doesn't have to work. In fact, the idea won't work most of the time, and we love that. We celebrate it. We learn from it because the game is learning. We talk about the meta skill of the 21st century is learning. Not can you figure out the strategy, but can you just learn? How good are you at learning? And that has to do with iteration of failure. So we have to embrace it, love it, enjoy it, celebrate it. I mean, actually say, wow, that you, what a miserable failure. Awesome. Because you did it. You tried. You did courage. It took you courage, and we learned a ton from that. This is great. This is great. I mean, that's not just a sort of, I don't know, thing you say. It's like a thing you have to really believe. So absolutely true. I know I need to finish up here. So what's the last one?
Two more. Management.
Oh, right. Okay, two more. So management. Let me just be real quick on that. We were told, and we have been told, that there's leaders and there's managers. And leaders lead, and managers don't lead, and leaders don't manage. So the leader is the person that can't be bothered to answer their email. You know, they can't be bothered to fill out the expense report. They're a leader. And we bought into that dichotomy. That leadership is this sort of larger-than-life person who can't be bothered with administration. They're too important for administration. They're too important to respond to things or be on time. You know what I'm saying? And the irony is, in this new system, in new power systems, I think there's an elevation of the manager's skill. That actually, that's the leader we need, is a person who can manage a system, who can steward a system. Not a person that's like, has to show their power by not participating in the system. You follow me? That actually what we're going to need is to be able to design and then manage systems that serve people. That's a crucial skill in the time in which we live. That dichotomy of like, leaders don't manage and managers don't lead. It's just getting us into trouble going forward. Also, the communication competence of a manager is different too. So let me just say one quick thing about that. The leader that doesn't manage, you know, that person, they're going to be typically a good communicator. So preaching, that kind of thing, right? It's not that communication isn't important in the new power system. It's how we communicate, which is different. You don't have to be a great preacher to be a truly effective and great leader in this system, which again is bad news because we spend so much time trying to become good preachers. And that old power system is just not as necessary anymore. But what you do have to be able to do in communication competency is you have to be able to motivate through writing, in team settings, and maybe most importantly, eyeball to eyeball, face to face. Like to really be able to call people to change and action, that's what a good manager does. It's not that there isn't a place for communication competency, it's just not necessarily upfront big group. I still think that's a valuable skill to have. I'm not belittling that. I'm just saying it's not as central as it was in an old power system. Again, for some of you, that's really good news because you're like, I'm not that great of a public speaker, whatever. Happy day for you. Some of you are like, man, I've spent a lot of time trying to be a great preacher, and I'm sorry, that's bad news. I can't make the world different for you. It's just not as important as it was. In fact, the big, big room public speaking stuff is increasingly going to just draw criticism. is all it's going to do. It's kind of like, you don't want to do that anymore. You want to lead in different ways. You want to be a manager. You want to be able to set up a system and then help people perform within that system. Walk alongside people and make sure that that system is stewarded and producing something that it's meant to produce. Okay, so let's go to the last one, which is heart. And what I really mean is like, well, I mean leading from a place of passion, commitment, and love. Love. Like love for what you do, love for your people, love for your community, love for your city. Like genuine love. Leadership, this is what I said in the beginning, leadership is essentially emotional. It's an emotional transaction. It's not mystical. It's not mechanical. So what we need is emotional strength, vulnerability, and nerve. This is what we could call the non-anxious leader. Or another, what I like to say is what moves us, moves us. What moves you emotionally is what's going to move your people forward. If you are not touched or affected emotionally by what you're saying or what you're asking people to do, they will not be moved either. So we lead from our heart to people's hearts. You have to speak to the heart and draw out the heart. And the only way that you can do that is to speak with your heart. And that means digging down deep and getting in touch with your own heart, your own feelings, your own sense of emotional intensity about a thing. Now, you don't have to react the way I react or Fitz reacts or anybody else. Your genuine expression of emotion will be clear to people that fits who you are and your personality. For me, it's like almost like a fierceness or an anger that I feel, like an intensity. That's emotion for me. For you, it might be softer. It might be kindness. But people know emotion when they see it and they feel it. And your heart is what will reach another person's heart. And I just don't know of a way to lead in our time where you're just mechanical or where you're somehow divorced from that personal, vulnerable expression of yourself. I'll leave you with this last thing. Don't you love Paul Tillich? Does anybody like Paul Tillich? The strange work of love is to destroy all that is not love. Strange work of love is to destroy all that is not love. Before he died, Fred Rogers was asked to be on Oprah. This was actually in the early days of Oprah. You know Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
I have to check in with you on these pop culture references. And Fred, from Walking Dead, Fred Rogers. And Fred Rogers said to Oprah, "Listen, I'm happy to come on." And she's like, "We want to talk about childhood development and these kind of things. The pedagogy stuff." And he said, "That's great. I'm happy to come." But he said, "You please don't have any children in the audience. You don't want to have any children in the audience." And she said, no, it'd be great. We'll have kids in the audience. It'd be great." And he said, no, you really don't want to do that. And Fred Rogers' people really tried to press her to say, "This is a bad idea. You don't want to have kids in the audience." And this was his reason why. He said, "If you have kids in the audience, problem is, my heart is kids. They're everything to me. And if they're there, I'll have trouble paying attention to you at all." This is what he said. "I don't know that I'm going to be able to be a good interviewee or focus on your questions or anything if there are children in the room." And he warned them. But they thought it'd be great TV. So they ignored him. And they had kids there. You can go back and look on YouTube. So there's kids there sitting with their moms, little kids, and they have questions too. And sure enough, in the middle of the interview, he's all wired up and stuff. He just leaves the chair. She's trying to talk to him. And he comes down and he sits at the level with the kids and he's like, come talk to me. And so he starts having this, he forgets all the adults in the room. That's the focus of a called man. That's a man who led with his heart. And he was interested in the hearts of other people. And it's not a surprise to me that Fred Rogers is a new pop culture icon in our time. Listen, that matters. That means something. Even 20 years ago, he would have been a laughing stock if we put him up as a leadership example. In the Great Man Myth story, he's not. He's humble. He's silly. What, did he weigh 173 pounds or whatever for his whole entire life? 143 pounds his whole entire life. And he said, well, that means the letters I is one letter, love is four letters, you is three letters, and that's why God let him be 143 pounds his whole entire life. Who is this person? There's one story, I don't know if it's true or not, but there's a story out there about him that some people stole his car, and when some criminals, robbers, stole his car, when they found out it was Fred Rogers' car, they returned it with a note apologizing. That's leadership. That's what I mean by heart. Rate yourself on that. How emotionally honest are you? How vulnerable are you? How much do you lead with your heart to people's heart? Be honest with yourself.